Hello and welcome back. How are you? This is My Mate Bought a Toaster, the podcast that opens up celebrities' Amazon accounts to tell their life story. It's a simple premise, but it's one that has occupied my life for the last 2.5 years. And many of you have been so nice to listen to the show and give us lots of lovely reviews. So thank you very much for that. I hope you are enjoying Series 6. We are getting towards the end of it now. We've got Danny Robbins today. Wonderful Danny Robbins, the increasingly spooky Danny Robbins. That has become his thing of late, and we'll talk lots about that during this show. So if you are a fan of Uncanny or the Battersea Poltergeist and you've come here because of that, then I hope you enjoy a little bit more insight into the spooky mind of Danny Robbins. And if you are a regular listener, welcome back. So as usual, a few bits of admin. What can I tell you? My shoulder's hurting. That's a brief bit of admin. I know, it's in my left shoulder. Does that mean heart attack? So this could be my last ever episode. Also, I've had a rubbish few weeks. Very sadly, my beloved, most wonderful creature in the world, my dog, Polly, died 2.5 weeks ago. So I've had a really shit couple of weeks, actually. But doing this podcast and hearing from you lot and editing it and doing some interviews has really kept me going. So I don't know why I'm thanking you lot, but thanks for listening, because without you listening, I wouldn't bother to do the podcast. So you are kind of involved. So anyway, that's what's been going on with me. Hurty shoulder and slight heartache. But apart from that, all is well. I hope all is good with you. I hope you enjoyed today's episode. As ever, don't forget, give us a lovely review, give us a lovely rating, give us a lovely big fat subscribe, and give us a follow on all the socials at ToasterPod on the bits and bobs. Enjoy Danny Robbins. See you soon now. Does it help people? Don't pass talking to these funny people. He's asking what they find in the town stories. Can somebody yell out the name of the show, please? It's My Mate Bought a Toaster. Oh, it's My Mate Bought a Toaster. Yeah, yeah, My Mate Bought a Toaster. Oh, oh, toaster for my love, thank God, toaster. Hello, welcome back. It's another episode of My Mate Bought a Toaster. Thank you so much for listening. And this week, I am very, very pleased to be joined by a brilliant actor, a writer, a podcaster, and I mean, he's a spooky man as well. But we'll talk more about that, I'm sure. Please welcome the wonderful Danny Robbins. Hello, Danny Robbins.
Hello, Tom.
How are you?
I'm all right. I'm not too bad. I'm kind of excited.
Okay, good. Well, I'm glad you're excited, and thank you so much for sending me all your Amazon details. It's worth saying, Danny, that, you know, we have different approaches from different guests on this show. Sometimes people say, yeah, log in, mate, it's fine. And sometimes people just send me screenshots. And I honestly, I promise you, I don't mind what they do. And you were fully up for sending me the logins, and then there was an intervention by your other half, wasn't there? Who doesn't trust them. I feel fine about this, but basically your other half said, no, I'm not letting this man have the logins to our Amazon account.
She just would not have it. I mean, we literally had an argument about it in the kitchen last night where I was like, I've known him for years. It's fine. He won't rob us. And she was just like, no, I'm not having it. No way. And she sat there and I was like, but it'll take ages to do all these screenshots. This is, we're talking like a decade of screenshots of Amazon purchases. And she was like, I'll do it. It's fine. But you are not giving Tom the details.
I think she's right.
The only reason that I am able to do this program is the pandemic, because I had sworn pre-pandemic that I was going to give up Amazon. I was part of that kind of whole wave of like going to move away, going to go back to like, you know, I'm going to support small bookshops. I don't mind traveling 7 miles to get my, you know, my copy of the latest Richard Osman book. But, you know, obviously the pandemic blew all that, and instantly I was kind of stockpiling and bulk buying sort of Star Wars books for the kids and Lego and just anything to keep us busy during the pandemic. So there you go.
The addiction goes on. Their shares went up by something like 50%, didn't they? Or something ridiculous, maybe not 50, but they went up enormously during the pandemic.
I'm sure he made like an extra £19 billion, Jeff Bezos, I think.
Yeah, or as he calls it, two rockets.
I'm just making that up, obviously. But
we should say all facts that Danny and I spout during this episode are completely made up. It's really important to establish that.
At some point, my wife will intervene and just say, stop.
Don't tell him. We're going to go back to your earliest order, first of all. This is 8th of December, 2013. Okay, this is when we're going back to. And there is a Lucky Luke movie poster. This cost £10. Tell us a bit about this, please.
Well, this is actually quite a sentimental purchase. This is bought because my brother had a son called Luke. And I was looking around thinking, what do you give a boy called Luke? And I, you know, I sort of resisted the obvious Skywalker temptation and went Lucky Luke. And I think, I'm pretty sure it's either in Spanish or French. It's got that slightly cool kind of hipster spin to it as well.
Yes, it's it says Lucky Luke El Intrepido.
There you go. I'm guessing that's Spanish.
It's it says Argentine. Argentine.
Oh, really? Oh, right. Yeah. An Argentinian Lucky Luke. Well, it's even more exotic than I thought.
Yes, it is. Yes, it is. Well, Lucky Luke's obviously very lucky. He's got a fantastic uncle. He's done what he's looked at. He's looked out there. He's looked out.
he really has.
This is nice. Okay, so your brother, do you have an older brother? Do you have a younger brother?
I've got a younger brother, and for a long time we did not get on at all when we were kids, and we used to do terrible things to each other. I remember him throwing a golf ball and hitting me on the eye socket. And just sort of chasing each other around the house, and like, you know, horrible things, like where you'd argue and then one of you would like grab a knife from the drawer and wave it at the other person. And I think we were very, very different, really different kids. I was into theatre and sort of messing about and kind of putting on costumes and putting on voices. And he was really into football and, like, you know, latterly kind of going out boozing with the lads. We grew up in Newcastle and, like, he had a Geordie accent. I didn't have a Geordie accent. He was a bit more of a lad. I was, you know, sort of, you'd have been forgiven for thinking I was stolen by the Pixies and taken off. And,
by the band, the Pixies.
Yeah, exactly. By the band, the Pixies coming in and forcing me to be an indie superstar.
Yeah.
I was a very kind of middle class Geordie kid, and he kind of aspired to being a sort of proper Geordie. But, you know, as adults, we've kind of actually discovered we've got lots of things in common. And he is now, he's an amazing woodworker.
Oh, right.
He's incredible with wood. He finds bits of driftwood on the beach. He lives near the sea now, and just, he takes them and makes sculptures out of them, and he makes coffee tables and all sorts of tables. He does properly exquisite stuff. So, you know, it's interesting. He has found his own way of being arty as an adult.
Yes, that's rather lovely. Daddy, I've known you for years. I didn't know you had anything to do with Newcastle. You hid that so well.
Well, yeah, I mean, I for a long time, I was a member of a Facebook group called Yes, I'm from Newcastle, and No, I don't have a Geordie accent. I've had to defend myself my entire life. And it's strange because, you know, you never meet somebody from London and go, hang on a minute.
No.
You haven't got a Cockney accent. What's going on? You can't possibly come from London. But, you know, like, anybody from Newcastle is given this kind of third degree grilling if you don't have a Geordie accent. And, you know, I mean, I what can I say? I'm a middle class kid. I mean, you know, I the next thing that comes is always like, oh, so you went to some sort of posh private school. I'm like, no, I went to a perfectly ordinary school. I was just bullied.
Such a happy story. All right, so already we've dug in. We found out you're from Newcastle. This is good. You can see here on the 24th of September 2013, Toddler Calm, A Guide for Calmer Toddlers and Happier Parents.
Well, it's interesting. That's 2 days after my own birthday. And I clearly was rewarding myself by trying to sort out my life. Yeah, I mean, so that was... That would have been just a few months after my son was born. My son was born in July 2012. So... yeah, I think we were going through that that idea of trying to control the uncontrollable. All those books you buy as a brand new parent thinking that you can learn how to do this, you know, and I think there's a whole rash of them there, like, you know, how to bring up boys.
Oh, raising boys in the 21st century, completely updated and revised. I bet there's been some revisions, lads.
There you go.
I bet there's been some revisions there.
There you go. I mean, it's brilliant, isn't it? It plays to all your fears and anxieties, you know, that they're kind of brilliantly marketed, brilliantly written to give you just enough of a sense that there might be some hope.
Yes.
But also, you know, not quite enough. You can't survive on the book alone. You've also got to then pay for the course with the person who wrote the book.
Yes.
Go on the kind of 6-week course about how to do it. And I think I just gave up at a certain point. I think I just kind of realized that actually people had been bringing up children since cavemen times, and you know, you kind of have to learn on the job and you make your mistakes. And I think, you know, I did read things which were helpful.
Yeah.
I'm sure I did.
Yeah.
And there's some really interesting things in those books about raising boys, about kind of the need for different things at different points in their lives. Like, I remember reading about how the mother was incredibly important at the beginning, then the father becomes more significant a few years in. Mm. And then there's a point in their lives, I think, when they're sort of maybe hitting teenagedom, where they need another adult outside of
the parent. Yes, we had this with Josh Howie the other day. You know, Josh was talking about this. When, when the kid turns 12, when the boy, I think specifically a boy turns 12, he starts to need a new role model. And that breaks my heart, because I am the role model, but I've only got about another 2 years left, and then he's going to be, and I'm worried it's going to be a YouTuber, Danny. That's my worry.
Well, this is the thing, YouTuber or like teacher, football coach, parole officer, you know, whatever, whatever it is, you know, there's someone out there who can help your child.
I've got an idea. Come with me on this.
Go on.
Get your kids into My Mate Bought a Toaster, right? My kids are already obsessed with Uncanny, your fantastic podcast, right? I will become your kids' idol, right? You can become theirs, and we'll just keep communicating about what we want to try and get the others to do, right? So we can control them, but they think that they've got us like an external idol, but actually we've just got a WhatsApp group where we're making all the decisions.
Oh my days, this is so embarrassing. I don't remember buying all these silly little strange things. I swear on my life, I was forced by my wife with an ABBA pen knife that I bought on ABBA. Wait a minute.
All right, look, let's crack on through. 2014, we can see the kids in your life, loads of, we've got things like Fireman Sam. I love Fireman Sam. I miss watching Fireman Sam with my little boy. Look, here we go. This is notable. Danny Robbins from the Fabulous Uncanny podcast. The Haunting of Hill House, bought on the 25th of November, 2014.
It's one of the greatest ghost stories ever written. I would recommend it wholeheartedly to anybody. And it spawned a wonderful film, The Haunting, in the 1950s, which I think is one of the great horror movies ever, really. It spawned a terribly, terribly bad remake with Liam Neeson and Catherine Zeta-Jones in, which we just don't talk about. But mm-hmm. then it obviously spawned this new series, The Haunting of Hill House, on Netflix as well, which is great. So I mean, Shirley Jackson, it was the gift that kept on giving. It's spawned a lot of great screen adaptations. There is a play knocking around as well that I've got on my bookshelf. It's a little bit of an obsession for me as a story. It's just, I think it was one of the key inspirations for me in telling ghost stories. I mean, I remember reading one time that it's very hard to make long ghost stories, that most of the best ghost stories are short stories, like, you know, M.R. James being the kind of one of the classic examples.
Have you read that? Have you read Michelle Pfeiffer?
Thin Air. Yeah. I was wondering what you were looking at there. You've just plucked that from your bookshelf. Thin Air by Michelle Pfeiffer is bloody great. Yeah, it's well, I mean, do you want to tell people what it's about?
Well, no, I think you should, but I was just pointing out how thin it is, how tiny it is, because why should they be short? Because they sort of lure you in and it should be a short, sharp punch. Is that the theory as to why ghost stories are short?
Well, because it's hard to maintain scares, I think. And because, you know, in any ghost story, the power is lost when you reveal the ghost, and it's hard to sort of keep from revealing the ghost the longer you go. That book, Michelle, is it Pfeiffer or Pfeiffer? I never quite know.
Question. You say Pfeiffer, I'll say Pfeiffer.
Okay, let's call the whole thing off. But it's a great story. It's about some mountaineers making an ascent. I can't remember if it's Everest or a similar mountain, I think, and about the ghosts that mountaineers see. And it's a really good story. But yeah, I mean, you know, one of my passions is ghost stories, and I've certainly bought a few on Amazon over the years. But lots of collections of short stories, like there's E. Nesbitt Horror Tales, I think they're called, or Horror Stories, maybe. Mm-hmm. You know, M.R. James, which Mark Gatiss has been adapting so brilliantly on BBC4. I think this is a golden age for ghost stories now. There's a load of ghost story novels and short stories coming out now. It's a really good time to be like into reading ghost stories.
Yes, it has. It's become a very zeitgeisty thing. I wonder why that is. Is that because of the greater disruptions in the world at the moment, be they climate apocalypse, be they World War III? Do you think because of those enormous things going on, we look to ghost stories as comfort? Like we were saying earlier on about comfort with other things. Do you think ghost stories are really comforting because we can control the fear?
I do. I think it's definitely connected to what's going on at the moment. I think there's a state of chaos and uncertainty and sadly death that is very much present in society at the moment. I think you can draw parallels with post-First World War and post-Second World War, where you had those kind of similar conditions, obviously on a grander scale. And people reach for the paranormal. They reach for... They want explanations. They want to be reassured the idea that there might be something after death. And Yeah, and I think you said, I mean, you can even track back to like Jacobean times, and Jacobean drama is full of ghosts and blood and witchcraft and horror. And, you know, in that situation, it's kind of reflecting the horror of society, the division of society and plague and, you know, these witch hunts. And, you know, I mean, draw your parallels, you know, however you want to now.
Yeah. All the good stuff.
Yeah, exactly. But I think it definitely, you know, it comes out of the kind of society we're living in at the moment. Horror is huge at the moment. Look at Netflix. Mm. It's plastered with horror. Horror is the number one genre there. And to some degree, that's reflecting the horror of society. And you're right. It does offer a sense of reassurance. I think ghosts are simultaneously frightening and reassuring. And something about the fear they induce that is kind of comforting. It's that sort of pleasurable shiver down your spine.
Yes. And when you were buying this book back in 2014, could you have possibly had any idea then? Obviously, you say you've always had a passion for the ghost stuff, but at this point in your career, what's going on in 2014, please, career-wise? You're writing, you're still acting, or what?
Yeah, it's interesting. I've always been obsessed with ghosts, and I have done things about ghosts over the years. I mean, you might remember me doing a show like a long time ago called Live Ghost Hunt in Edinburgh, which was a spoof of things like Most Haunted. So the recent stuff I've been doing about ghosts has been a long time coming. It's something that's brewed since childhood. But As you know, I mean, we've worked together over the years on comedy stuff. You know, I was a comedy writer for a very long time and performing comedy. And I started out doing stand-up when I was 15 years old in like the pubs in the Northeast. Yeah, I mean, me and Ross Noble,
we were really good
friends, Ross Noble and I, back then. And we were in Youth Theatre together, and we used to drive around in Ross's car doing stand-up gigs in places like Hartlepool and Middlesbrough and Sunderland, like, you know, quite scary pubs. And so I did comedy for a long time, and I think I just hit a point where I wasn't feeling very fulfilled, and I was feeling a little bit like, I don't know, I wasn't getting a kick out of being facetious and frivolous, and I wanted to do something a little bit more with a bit more emotional weight, I guess, and something that maybe said something about the world. And I wrote a play version of this series I did called Rudy's Rare Records with Lenny Henry that we did on Radio 4. And we did a play version of it, and it went quite well. So then I wrote another play, and that went quite well. And then that sort of got me into writing drama a bit more. And then the Battersea Poltergeist was really the coming together of my love of ghosts and my interest in writing drama. And that kind of opened the doors. And, you know, I mean, but even before Battersea, actually, I'd made a series called Haunted, which was about ghost stories, which very directly actually came out of the research for my play 222, A Ghost Story, that's been on this year in the West End. I was researching about ghost stories. I just said on social media, has anybody I know seen a ghost? Lots of people gave me ghost stories. And then it was suddenly friends of friends, and it was strangers, and it kind of grew and snowballed. Yeah. And just, I got all these ghost stories coming to me, and I was like, I've got to do something with these. So then that gave birth to Haunted, and that was back in 2017. Oh, and I guess that was the prototype for Battersea Poltergeist and Uncanny.
I just love how this, and the success, and I love the fact that, you know, I drive into work down Shaftesbury Avenue on a Saturday morning, and I drive past your play on Shaftesbury Avenue, and I love the fact, and I just think, fuck, that's Danny, that's so, so cool. And I love the fact that this is, obviously it has long roots in everything you've been doing, but also, yeah, it's just a Twitter thread that's gone well. Brilliant, love that, amazing. You know, you put it out there, and here we go.
It's funny, isn't it, how things come about. Mm. And you never know what's going to make sense and what's going to lead you where. And I think, you know, like collaborating with people who you collaborated with on stuff over the years, and, you know, you kind of do some sort of throwaway thing with them years ago, and then actually they come back into your life and they end up being a really important collaborator. Yeah. So there's a lovely line from a poem by Tennyson, Ulysses, which is, I am part of all that I have met. And I always think about that. And I think about how we're these kind of, you know, like this glass that can be filled up with, little pennies, if you like. You can fill this glass with pennies. Each one of these pennies is a person you met, or like a thing that happened to you, or a story that someone told you. And it kind of fills up and up and up. And at the end of it, you're rich.
Oh, that's great. Oh, good. Shaftesbury Avenue, West End Theatre. You bloody are, Danny. You bloody are. Well, actually, I'm surprised you're not more poor, to be honest, with all the shopping you've been doing on Amazon. There's so much stuff. Look, this is really interesting. Here on the 2nd of September 2014, this is obviously a very big part of your life. You bought The Almost Nearly Perfect People by Michael Booth and Fishing in Utopia, Sweden and the Future That Disappeared. So there is a part of your life, and Aquavit and the new Scandinavian cuisine. There is a big part of your life that's Scandinavian. and that's embodied in a person. So tell us about your Scandinavian connection, please, Danny, because we can see this here.
Yeah, so in 2005, I was performing in a pub theatre in Camden, and I looked out into the audience and I saw this girl who I instantly fell madly in love with. She had blonde hair, blue eyes.
On stage! You were on stage!
I was on stage, and she was in the audience, in the middle of the audience, a small theatre, like 50-seater theatre, so I could see her really clearly, staring back at me. And I just felt this incredible connection. And, you know, she now says she felt it too. And our eyes locked on. And I was like, I've got to talk to her after the show. And so I talked to her after the show. And basically, since then, we've never really spent a day apart. You know, like, it's my wife. And I talked to her, and after the show, I had no idea where she was from. I couldn't place her accent. I was like, is she from Manchester? Where is she from? And it turned out she was from Sweden. And I didn't know anything about Sweden at all. I don't think at that point I even really knew that IKEA was from Sweden. I just had zero knowledge of Sweden. And then I went out to Sweden with her and met her parents. And the more I learned about it, the more I became fascinated by it. I think it's a really interesting country for British people, because I think a lot of it is recognizable and similar. Mm. And I think that's why we enjoy a lot of Swedish culture, like, you know, the kind of Nordic noir detective things. It feels familiar to us. And yet it's also got this kind of exoticness to it as well. There's a sense that the Swedes do things better. I think we often look at Sweden as a model of how society should be. And, you know, you get politicians going out there and kind of trying to learn from the Swedes. And undoubtedly, they have a very good quality of life. And they, I mean, I'm not going to lie, they do things better than us. And,
I thought it was going to be a twist in the tale. I was waiting for you to say, well, they don't actually. The fact of the matter is.
You know, well, you know, I can certainly, there are things I would criticise. I mean, I think sometimes it feels a little bit stifling and conformist. And there is a kind of slight Stepford Wives kind of uniformity to some aspects of Swedish small town life. But you know, but anyway, I became fascinated by Swedish society and obviously very much in love with my wife. And so I learned Swedish and I learned more and more about Sweden. And this kind of eventually gave birth to a sitcom series called The Cold Swedish Winter, which some people might know that I've done for Radio 4. It's kind of, I think we've done 5 series of it now. And it was about a man who moved to Sweden, played by Adam Richards, this stand-up comedian who moved out to Sweden, and about him adapting to Swedish life as a fish out of water, a fish in sort of very icy water. Yeah. And it's been a load of fun to write. We'd go and record it every summer in Sweden. We'd have a week in Sweden recording with Swedish actors. It was beautiful. It's really been a really blissful job. And for me, like, really interesting, just exploring Swedish society and clearly something I've got a deep connection with. And now I have 2 half Swedish, half English children, Swinglish children. So it's been a pleasure. And I've also written a play set in Sweden as well. So I think it's a subject I keep coming back to.
Do your kids speak Swedish?
My older son speaks it much better. I think when my wife was off on maternity leave with him, she spoke a lot of Swedish to him. And then I think when my second son came along, things were a bit more full on and you've got 2 kids and it was a bit more chaotic. And she didn't manage to kind of do that kind of nice sort of, you know, speaking Swedish to him, kind of really sort of, you know, intimate kind of focus on that. And so he doesn't speak Swedish as well. The older one's had lessons as well and the younger one hasn't. But we're really hopeful that they both will do that, I think. Yes. I mean, that would be lovely. And we've talked a lot about, would we go and spend a year living in Sweden? During the pandemic, that was all we talked about, really, that idea of moving to Sweden.
Oh, my God, I can imagine.
We were really close to it. And then Brexit. And suddenly, it was impossible to do it. It's mad. Like, it went from being so possible, I could have literally just gone over there and lived there if I wanted, to not be able to do it. And it wasn't, I mean, it was part Brexit, not being an EU citizen anymore, but also Sweden had really tightened their rules. They've had this horrible kind of knee-jerk backlash to the fact that they were one of the most welcoming countries for refugees. They took in more refugees per capita, I think, than anywhere other than Yemen, I think I'm going to say. It was incredible, like really amazing. You know, Sweden totally changed almost overnight. They welcomed so many people. But unfortunately, there's been this backlash. And part of that is that they've really clamped down on people being able to go to Sweden. So now Eva, even though she is Swedish, wouldn't automatically have the right to bring her husband. And the mad thing is, she's an EU citizen, so she could go to Denmark or Portugal or any other country and take me as her spouse because
and
that's
you'd be
the
fine.
Rule
and you could just stay
in EU countries. Yeah, but she can't take me to Sweden, so it's become really difficult. We you know, it's a very different process to what it would have been.
Gosh, that's sad. That's very, very sad. By the way, I absolutely love that you were doing a gig and you just saw your wife in the audience. How did the gig go? Because that would have put me off.
It went really well. The irony of it is that it was this show. I don't know if you remember the show I did called DJ Danny, which was about...
Oh, yeah, of course. Oh, my God.
Yeah, creating a DJ character. I mean, I'll be honest with you. The whole show was kind of created to try and make me attractive to girls. And I was like going to go out and go to Edinburgh and go like, hello, ladies, you know, and kind of imagine every night kind of women swooning as I did this incredible DJ mixing character. And then I met Eva like a month before going up there. And clearly the idea of meeting girls was off the menu at that point, you know. I mean, it was love at first sight. It was wonderful. It was what the Swedes call kärlek vid första ögonkastet, which is love at first eye chucking.
Beautiful. It was so romantic. Someone put that on a card and frame it. That's gorgeous.
it was beautiful though. And you know, we're still very much in love all this time later, you know, all these years later and two kids later.
And she'll know there's trouble if you reinstate DJ Danny character. That'll mean there's problems afoot. All right, good. Okay, Danny Robbins, let's move on now. Let's power on through. Loads of stuff for the kids here. We're seeing Playmobil sports stuff. We're seeing Disney Car Wars. We're seeing the Cannon and Ball show, Mike Reed live at the Palladium. All for the kids.
That's definitely not for the kids.
They love Mike Reed. What's going on with Mike Reed?
Do you want to know why I bought those?
Yes,
do you want to know why I bought those?
Yes.
Okay, there is a reason, I promise you. I wrote a play called End of the Pier, which was on at the Park Theatre a few years back, and it starred Les Dennis. And Blake Harrison from The Inbetweeners, and Nitin Ganatra from EastEnders, who was brilliant, and also Tala Gouveia, who's now on that detective thing set in Bath with Jason Watkins that I can't remember the name of. But anyway, great cast. But Les Dennis is the nicest man I've ever met. Probably, I think
he's been on this podcast. He came into this podcast, and it was a delight.
Such a nice man. But but anyway, the play was about two comedians, a father and a son. The father was part of that kind of old world working men's comic scene from the 70s, the kind of world of Cannonball and Little and Large. And the son was a kind of new upcoming alternative comedian. And it was explored racism in comedy and explored the idea about how comedy needs victims and about how comedy can be a cruel and brutal and kind of negative thing as well as a positive thing. So sort of explored the culpability and responsibility of comedy. And so I found myself watching a lot of stuff from that era, that 70s era, Cannonball, Little and Large, the kind of, was it called the Wheel Tappers and Shunters Club, something like that. But like loads of the comedians, like loads of stuff from that era. Yeah. And, you know, and a lot of it is quite bleak and drags you down. That, you know, there is racism, there's sexism, there's a lot of kind of prejudice. But there are also some amazing, talented practitioners of comedy within that era as well. Some brilliant joke tellers and, you know, some people who were absolutely part of a tradition that stretched right back to Victorian music hall. So it was a really interesting process looking at that period and comparing it to our time. And I hung out with one or two people. I met Sid Little, for instance.
Oh, really? And, oh, my God. I used to love Little and Large.
Spent a bit of time with Sid. I've got this amazing, enduring memory of Sid in a dressing room in Hull. He was doing pantomime. And he was cooking his dinner. I'm going to try and remember this. I think he had it was a sort of roast dinner and a summer fruits pudding from Marks and Spencer's. And he was cooking them by wrapping them in tin foil and sellotaping them to his electric radiator.
Wow.
So he was heating them up on the radiator to eating them. Oh, and I'm not sure if that's safe. I wouldn't want to endorse that method of cooking and tell people to do that. I'm not sure if it's safe to eat a roast dinner you've cooked on a radiator.
All it says on there is do not cover. At no point does it say do not cook a roast dinner on here.
That's exquisite.
But it was beautiful. Exquisite. And there was me thinking, look, this is a man who played to 20 million people on BBC One. At one point, he was a proper comedy god. I mean, those guys, it doesn't get bigger than that. Cannonball, Little and Large, they were huge. The kind of viewing figures that we can only dream of now. But you know, he was incredibly humble and really nice. And I think people of that era, they find it quite hard to understand why it ended for them. You know, it was like that. I mean, it was seismic. The end of that era was as seismic as the dinosaurs being hit by the asteroid and life dying out. It just suddenly ended for that era of comedians. And very few of them are on your TV screens now. You know, you see kind of Bobby Ball, you know, when he was alive, he cropped up in Lee Mack's Not Going Out, you know, towards the end of his life. But, you know, there was very few people like that who still sort of, you know, were around, you know, and kind of in our consciousness. I mean, most of the people kind of just disappeared and were kind of banished.
They just got stopped. But it wasn't like they were cancelled for being awful, particularly. Like Russ Abbott, you still see every now and again, but you're right. It's weird how overnight they seem to disappear. People talk about overnight success. You very rarely talk about overnight for other than for reasons of being cancelled. Let's not get into that now. But that idea of a generation being switched off just because of time passing was, you're right, it's extraordinary.
And I think they found it very hard to understand, really. And I think they had this fundamental disconnect. They couldn't see what was funny about, in inverted commas, alternative comedy. You know, their inverted commas. You know, they couldn't understand why that was funny at all. And there was just, you know, the younger comics coming through couldn't see what was funny about the old guys, and the older guys couldn't see what was funny about the younger guys. I think now you get people, you look at someone like a Peter Kay or a Jason Manford, and I think they tap into that kind of older tradition, you know, that they kind of embody the best of that world, you know, that kind of lovable kind of, you know, the kind of working class kind of entertainer, you know, kind of proper crafted jokes. I think you see a kind of, there's a certain nostalgia for the good parts of that scene now.
Do you ever think about going back to stand-up? Would you ever go back to stand-up again?
No, and I think I probably have nightmares every so often about being on stage, being a stand-up. I don't think I was a natural stand-up. I love performing, and I really enjoyed doing character performance, but I don't think I was ever a natural stand-up, being myself and telling jokes from myself on stage. I hadn't been on stage for about 10 years until I did a live tour last autumn of The Battersea Poltergeist, my podcast. And I was a bit scared going back to it. And I was a bit worried that I wouldn't be able to do it. I have a recurring horrible flashback to a moment when I was in National Youth Theatre as a kid. And I was playing First Senator in a production of Othello with Chiwetel Ejiofor as Othello. And Rachel Sterling was Desdemona, and Orlando Bloom was a non-speaking soldier. I had more lines than Orlando Bloom. And I had this tiny part, First Senator, it's irrelevant part, and I dried on stage. And I'll tell you the precise reason I dried. I'd been to a eat-all-you-can-eat pizza buffet at Pizza Hut beforehand and eaten too much pizza, and I was feeling a little bit bloated, bit burpy on stage, and I couldn't really control the kind of 3D pizza burps I was doing in my mouth, and it threw me, and it sort of distracted me from the bard's prose. And I lost my lines, and it was horrible, and my body went into spasm. I started... If you can imagine my leg sort of, and my leg was flicking out, trying to sort of kickstart myself. It was horrible, like just spasming out. And it was horrific. And it stays with me to this day. It's one of the worst moments of my life. It's like a nightmare come to life. Yeah. And so it sits in my head every time I've got to do like public speaking. I think it's there ticking away. So when I was on stage doing the Battersea Poltergeist live, you know, I was a little bit like, you know, can I do this? And went out, and I was playing ridiculously huge theatres. I was playing like, you know, Brighton Theatre Royal, Guildford G Live, which is like 2,000 seater. You know, it was bonkersly big theatres. But it was fun. I enjoyed it. That's the main thing. And I think we'll do more live shows with Uncanny as well, hopefully. But I do love it. I really, really get off on it. But I think it's probably good that it scares me a bit as well. It's that, you know, maybe, I don't know, is that a thing for all performers? I suppose you lose the fear after a while, don't you? But it keeps you on your toes and it makes you sharp.
Yes, I think the key thing there is that you dried when you were an actor delivering lines. It's completely different to being a stand-up or a host doing a podcast or doing stand-up, because the whole point of stand-up, and I think that's why I lent towards it, is because the pure anxiety of being a required cog that has to move in that way and say those things for the whole show to work. I had... it's not as bad as that. I didn't end up fitting on stage because, you know, I'd had too many quattro formaggio. That didn't happen to me. But I did have a very similar thing when I did a play in Edinburgh 20 years ago, and I had to, it was the very naughty boy. I don't know if you remember me doing that years ago with Adrian Poynton, nearly 20 years ago now, Danny. Yeah. And I was playing John Cleese, and I just would have these, and other actors talk about this when you're live on stage and you're doing the same thing every night, you have an out-of-body experience. You're not present anymore because other things going on, and because you're so, it's so automated, it's so kind of muscle memory that your brain departs, and then you're just flooded with adrenaline, and then that's it, you shut down. Whereas when you're doing stand-up, you can just weave in and out of that, and that's okay. It's a lie. It's okay because you're in the moment, so you talk about it, you bring that into the show. But when you're in a play, you're pretending that you're not really performing, and that's the kicker.
Yeah, I remember, like, the very first day I started secondary school, we went in to our first ever PE lesson, and we were all a bit scared. And there was this quite scary teacher there called Mr. Schofield, and he was giving us his tips on what to do in PE. And he was like, "One thing, lads, that you must never do when you're doing PE is think." Right? Because if you think, like, for instance, you're up on a trampoline, you're bouncing, you're in midair, you think, you have an accident. You know? And at the time I was like, this is ludicrous. This man is telling me not to think. What's he talking about? But actually, there's a kind of kernel of truth to this that I think the best sports people, and I would say the best actors too, that's the reason I'm telling this story, is that they are instinctive. Yeah. If you overanalyze it too much, if you think too much, you do throw yourself. I think you've got to be in that moment. And I could be playing tennis and I might be a kind of few points up, and I'll start to think, oh, can I make this next serve? Am I going to do it? And I'll throw it and I'll lose the game. Mm. You know, I'm fascinated by sports psychology, and I'm always admiring of, like, you know, a Roger Federer who can be two sets and match point down and come back and win the game. How do you do that? You know, and it's all about being in that moment. And I think as an actor, you need to be in that moment. And I think maybe I'm more of a writer than an actor. I think I find it hard to be in the moment. I find myself analysing, looking at the situation, observing, you know, kind of having that outside eye, as you say. And that's when you start to sort of throw yourself. Actually, that's a great skill for a comedian, isn't it? Because to be constantly looking at what's going around on you and using it and drawing it in is exactly what you need in a comedian.
Yes, and it completely consumes all the different parts of your brain. That's what comedians love, is that doing stand-up is an absolute, like, you know, you are absolutely in the moment and you cannot possibly think about anything else, really, until you've really got some miles under your belt, and then you can start to maybe wander around. But when you're in the moment, you are in free fall. What I find really sort of, I guess it's ironic, the idea of you doing this enormous venue with the Battersea Poltergeist and, you know, a thing about fear. And in a way, you're kind of, you've made entertainment out of fear, and yet your greatest fear is being an entertainer. In a way, that great fear that sits back from when you were a kid is that moment. It's just a really interesting kind of, I don't know, the two sitting together. It's weird.
It's very interesting. You know, I mean, clearly the work I do now is about trying to induce a fear in an audience. And actually, the root of what your fear is doesn't matter in a way. As long as you can tap into a certain kind of fear, you can understand the fear of how people feel. So, I've not seen a ghost. I live vicariously for the people I talk to. But I can understand the fear through channeling a certain moment. Like, you know, I have a fear of heights, or that fear of drying on stage. You can kind of put yourself in the moment a little bit. And you know, fear is a transformative thing. It affects our mind, it affects our body. You know, it's literally something that changes your whole physiology. Incredibly potent, incredibly powerful.
Look, here you are again, dipping your toe into the fear. Richard Wiseman's Paranormality, The Science of the Supernatural. You bought this on 7th of November 2016. So this is obviously this thing is ticking along for you. And clearly, I mean, this is again a part of, this is what made Danny Robbins create Battersea Poltergeist, a pack of 24 spooky black plastic spiders for Halloween. I mean, there you are, Danny, once again, dabbling in the occult.
From Richard Wiseman to plastic spiders, that's quite a leap. No, it's interesting, isn't it? It is interesting to look back and see the different inspirations along the way. And that's a really interesting book, Richard Wiseman's Paranormality. And I think that the work that I make attracts skeptics and believers in equal measure. And I think it also attracts an even bigger group of people in the middle who aren't sure. And I'm, you know, skeptics and believers is kind of as binary as Brexit, really. You know, it doesn't get more opposed than, you know, ghosts exist, ghosts don't, you know, that kind of idea. It is life and death. And, you know, I think that Richard Wiseman is an incredibly intelligent man. He's an incredibly brilliant man and brilliant at sort of picking apart our superstitions and making sense of it and so on. But I find there's an aspect of that kind of scientific skepticism that is a little bit joyless for me. And I kind of feel like there's a danger in bleaching everything in the bright light of reason. We need to leave those shadows in the corner. We, as a society, we need to believe in ghosts. I think we have a real need for them. And so I think that, you know, I can see why a lot of people come to my podcast, because it appeals, you know, that idea that ghosts might exist is incredibly appealing. The idea that there might be magic, you know, and I'm very careful of having a foot in both camps and sort of treading both camps. And I am a skeptic who wants to believe, you know, I am literally in the middle, torn between the two. So I think it's brilliant to kind of arm myself with the knowledge and theories of Richard Wiseman. But then also I love the idea that he might be wrong and that there might be ghosts out there. And so I really am that kind of agnostic between the two.
Yes. And yet you said earlier on that you were a profound atheist and you come from a family of atheists. So ultimately, does that, have you at any point in doing Uncanny or the Battersea Poltergeist or all the plays, have you at any point actually stopped and thought, oh, well, maybe I've got this wrong?
Well, I come from a family of profound atheists. My mum was brought up a Catholic and she really, really rebelled against it. She became very ardently atheist. I was very conscious of an absence of belief as a kid, and going to my grandparents' house and seeing the pictures of the Pope and the slightly scary pictures of Jesus holding his Sacred Heart and looking down at me. And, you know, I was intrigued by the idea that I wasn't part of this and that I was maybe missing out on something. I wasn't part of this club of believers. And, you know, some people would have found God and I found ghosts. I went into ghosts. That was my magic. That was my belief. And, so that's what led me to this, I think, in big part, I think. I love the idea that there might be something out there. So I'm a coward, essentially. I'm an agnostic. I reserve the right to be wrong.
But has any of the stories, any of the uncanny things, because they are fantastic, and I assume a lot of my listeners will have listened to your podcast. If you haven't, guys, you must listen to Uncanny. It's and the Battersea Poltergeist. It's absolutely fantastic. I mean, actually, Danny, interesting talk about the way that there's no reason. I mean, obviously, I guess talking about ghosts, you should marry that up with faith. But it's quite interesting to listen to Uncanny with my kids. And as you know, because I've left you voice notes from my 6 and 9-year-old saying how much they enjoy the show. But it's quite interesting for us because we get to, it's a very safe and contained way to talk about fear, but also to talk about death and also to talk about belief and what people, how people approach these great questions. And when they're 6 and 9, you can say, well, you know, was that true or not? Well, no, it wasn't true. I don't believe it was true. And we all sit in the car and discuss it. And it's fantastic. But has there, in all these fantastic stories, has there been a moment where you're like, yeah, this is properly weird? Or do you end up walking away from everything going, I've managed what this story is in my head?
No, and the opposite. I would say that I choose stories where I can't offer easy answers and solutions. I would say all the stories really leave me with major questions. I think there are things that are genuinely inexplicable in pretty much all of them, really. And that's the enjoyment for me, actually. I think that, you know, a lot of people come to me wanting answers. You know, I get people saying to me like, so come on then, do ghosts exist? Do they? You know, and I'm like,
that's what I'm doing, Danny. You know, that is what I'm doing, yes.
I can't give you that answer. I can't give you that answer. But also, I'm not sure that you want that answer, because actually, in a way, the pleasure is the journey, you know. And, you know, a detective story is at its most enjoyable when you're not sure who the murderer is, isn't it?
Oh, yes.
Once you know the murderer, it's over. It's done. It's done. You know, then that book you've been loving reading, you can't read it anymore.
Yes.
So I sort of feel like the reason that we are still obsessed with the Enfield Poltergeist, the reason why Battersea had such a huge impact on people, is because they are robust enough to deflect skeptics. You know, that you cannot answer these things easily. And, you know, if I could just tell you, yeah, no, Battersea Poltergeist, that wasn't a ghost, or even if I could tell you Battersea Poltergeist, that was a ghost, you wouldn't need to listen to the series, because there's your answer. And I think, you know, I love the mystery of it. I love the fact that these are these locked room mysteries with this cast of suspects where one of the suspects could be a ghost. And, you know, if you're a skeptic, it's a how-done-it. If you're a believer, it's a who-done-it. Who's the ghost? And they're endlessly fascinating and endlessly satisfying. So I know I sort of feel like I choose my stories by the ones that send a shiver down my spine and by the ones where I feel like this is not easy to answer. You know, if I feel like I can just say, well, look, it probably was sleep paralysis, then there's no need for me to tell this story, because if I think that, then the chances are lots of people out there listening will. You know, I need to find stories that are going to keep you up at night guessing.
It would be such a disappointing... It'd be such a disappointing podcast where you absolutely conclusively within 5 minutes every time went, yeah, that's sleep paralysis, that's all that is. Yeah, that was a nervous breakdown, that one. Yeah, it's just your neighbour.
But it is a dilemma though, because it's interesting. You were talking about your kids, and I was very touched by the message that they left me on my phone the other day. That was lovely. And I was kind of shocked in a way that your youngest is 6 and listening to it. I mean, a brave, brave boy. Because I sort of find with my own 2 boys, one of whom is 6 and one's 9.
Snap.
It's difficult talking about these things. They're very aware that daddy is obsessed by ghosts and that he's doing stuff about ghosts all the time. And they're saying, like, you know, is it real? Are ghosts real? And you kind of, you know, you have to say to them, oh, no, don't worry, ghosts and monsters, that's not real. But actually, when you are genuinely unsure yourself and when the programs are about that uncertainty, it takes you into different, difficult territory with kids, I think. You know, there is that uncertainty.
Yes, well, of course, you can't. It's much harder for you. It's much easier for me because I get to be my Dawkins-esque belligerent self and every time say, well, it's nonsense, isn't it? Or enjoy the ride. It's a roller coaster. But for you, if you are living it and your kids are asking it, it's a completely different process because you've got to be honest and say, well...
Yeah, kids need to deal in black and white. They need Star Wars. You know, they need Jedi and Sith, Luke and Darth. And the world I'm dealing with is all about grey. You know, these are the grey areas, the uncertainties, the no man's land between life and death. And that's a much scarier place than anything that George Lucas ever created.
I tell you what's a much, much scarier place than any of the above. A kid's play tent.
Yeah.
26th of July, 2017. Is there anything worse than getting into one of those? £15 this cost for a visit to Hades.
Yeah. I tell you, there is nothing more terrifying than erecting a kid's tent. That was hard work.
Yeah.
Slotting all those poles into each. I remember being inside the canvas trying to slot in, like, going, Jesus, no, that's the wrong one. Why does it say in the instructions? We're like, that's the longer one. No, that's the shorter one. That was hard work. I think it was used... once and put in the cupboard.
They're incredibly hot and they get incredibly messy and the kids make you sit in there and you are the size of the tent. And
but
they work as a great analogy for the experience of being a parent to young kids, especially. When we eventually dismantled the tent, the tent was in their little playroom area for probably 2 years, maybe 2.5 years. And I hated it. And they'd go, I'd play in there with them and I'd be like, you know, whatever. And then one day it eventually had fallen apart and you dismantle it and throw it away and you feel tremendous sadness.
Yeah.
And you hate the whole thing while it's there. And then it goes and you're like, oh, sad day. Isn't that weird? It's so annoying.
Yeah. I mean, our attic is full of things that instill that kind of melancholy and poignancy.
Yeah. Yeah. Attics are for parents who can't let go. That's what they're for. Find us on Twitter and Instagram. @ToasterPod is the name we're trying to jam. It's simple like a sarnie filled with cheese and ham. @ToasterPod, I swear it's not a scam, I think. But there's loads of candles here. We've got packs and dinner candles. This is very nice indeed. I love this. And then we have got a miniature tequila. A Patron Reposado miniature tequila. This is on December 2019. 18th of December 2019. This is the pre-Christmas thing here, getting the tequilas in.
Yeah, I mean, that sounds pretty posh as well. I mean, certainly, Eva got into her kind of exotic booze around that time. But interesting you mentioned the candles, because that's a Swedish thing as well. Swedes love candles, and you have candles even at breakfast as well. So, really? Like, sometimes people come to our house and, like, we put out candles and they're like, ooh, special occasion. We're like, no, just, you know, it's what you do. I think, you know, Scandis, because they live so much of their lives in the dark, light becomes really, really important, you know. And I think candles... have a sort of symbolic significance to Swedes, I think, that idea of light and warmth. And there's this word in Swedish, which is mysig, which means coziness. It's a little bit like that Danish word hygge, which became very popular a while back, you know, and became a sort of totally misused in terms of lifestyle and furniture trends. But
yeah, it's not hygge, it's just a pair of jogging pants. It's not hygge. Yes.
exactly. But, you know, that need for coziness is really important when you live so much of your life in the cold and the dark.
I mean, it also helps for the purposes of the narrative thread of this podcast, Danny, that, you know, lighting candles, a little bit spooky. So we're sort of, you know, you can say it's part of the Swedish national identity, but, you know, the light and the dark, it does all sort of loop back in. There's themes here. There's texture to this.
Oh, definitely. You know, we're back to Luke Skywalker and Darth Vader.
Yeah. Secret Hitler board card game. What's Secret Hitler, please?
Oh, my God. This is such a good board game.
Ooh.
It's... So have you ever had Marcus Brigstock on this show?
No, I haven't, and I must have.
Okay.
Yes.
Okay, but good. I mean, hopefully people know who I'm talking about. Marcus and I used to live together years ago, like when we were students, and he introduced me to this on his stag do. We went on his stag do, and he was like, "Do you want to play Secret Hitler?" And I was like, "What the hell is that? That sounds really weird. Why would I want to play Secret Hitler?" And then he introduced me to it, and it's like, you know that game Murderer, where you kind of... you know, you sort of, you're trying to guess who is the murderer in the circle of people. And
oh, my God. God, what do we call it? Yes, I know the game. We have played a similar game, and I can't remember what it's called now. That's going to drive me mad. But yes, I know that format.
So, I mean, the premise of the game, I think it was created by these hipsters in New York, and the premise of the game is that Hitler and the Nazis are trying to take over the Reichstag in the early 30s, and that one person in the circle is, you know, some people are Nazis in the circle, some people are Democrats, and one person is Hitler, and you're essentially trying to work out who's what, and you're asking questions, and you're trying to deduce things, and it's a really gripping game. It's a really brilliant game, and the idea behind it is that it does somehow kind of make you aware of the dangers of fascism and how this happened. You know, I mean, it's a sort of a game that sort of has a certain kind of political point to it as well. But it's a hard game to introduce to people. You sort of
it's a bad title for a game. I'm not going to lie to you. If you come up to me with your Aryan wife and casually say, "With your candles lit, Danny, do you want to play Secret Hitler?" I'm going to worry.
I can understand that, yeah. And I've said it to people in the past, you know, "Do you want to play Secret Hitler?" and got some funny looks. But when you play it, it is incredibly gripping. It's incredibly addictive. And you've got to have that kind of the same qualities you have for poker. You've got to keep that poker face to kind of be able to get away with it.
I love those
games. So, yeah, I got really into board games around that period, I think. As you know, a lot of people did. Board games had this resurgence, didn't they, kind of a couple of years ago. And
Yes,
you know, it became the new kind of nostalgic kick to be playing tabletop board games again.
Yes, and here we are, 25th of March 2020, the beginning of lockdown, I think almost to the day when you got... what does Danny Robbins do? Like, lockdown has happened. Everyone's scared. Everyone's freaked out. It was a strange time. Danny gets poltergeist. That's what Danny does.
Is that the Colin Wilson book?
Yes.
Yeah, so this is like one of the seminal texts on poltergeist. Colin Wilson was this writer about the paranormal and kind of interesting man novelist as well. And it's a book all about poltergeist. And that was the very beginning of Battersea Poltergeist, because Battersea Poltergeist was commissioned exactly as we went into lockdown. So it was a real lockdown project. I made it during lockdown, and it was released of January 21, it would have been January 2021. So it spanned that period. And I think I'm pretty convinced it wouldn't have had the impact it did without the pandemic and lockdown, because I think it plunged us as a society into a moment where, you know, for the reasons we talked about earlier, we got very interested in ghost stories and the paranormal.
Yeah.
But also we became fascinated by this idea of a family cooped up. The story is about a family cooped up in their house, the claustrophobia of it. They're kind of cooped up because of the poltergeist, but also because of the nation's press assembled outside. And it felt like a very relatable story, I think. And also the third thing is that people would... desperate to be entertained. Like, all of us, we're just burning through entertainment at that point, weren't we? You went through Tiger King, you know, you went through Bridgerton or whatever. You were kind of going through all these things. You needed your next hit. And actually what we did was we did not give you the box set. We didn't give you the bingeable box set. We released an episode a week. And people at the beginning were going like, "Oh, how can you do this? Give me the binge. I want the binge."
Yeah.
And actually, ultimately they didn't, because I think they really enjoyed, people really liked the fact that it was coming out once a week. It was something to look forward to.
Yes.
It was like your appointment to listen, and you could do your research on the case in between. You know, people were kind of contacting Battersea yes. Library, getting old documents and maps. And,
yeah.
and yeah. I think that was nice. And now I look at things like Yellow Jackets, the American TV show, and the Book of Boba Fett for the Star Wars fans out there. They're being dropped once a week. It's a serial thing again. And I think that as a society, and Amazon is a huge part of this, as a society, we are jaded. We're jaded by the idea of having whatever we want, whenever we want it. You can have all the TV you want in the world whenever you want, on Netflix and whatever. You know, Spotify gives you music whenever you want. Actually, it's lovely to have to wait and to be plunged back to that moment as a kid when you were waiting for Doctor Who or whatever your favorite show was, building up to it, or, you know, having to take your money to the record shop and waiting to buy that record. Yeah. We need that again, I think. We want to be made to wait, and we enjoy that.
Absolutely. We're culturally saturated. And also we enjoy the moment of waiting. Like we were saying earlier on about the detective stories, the bit at the end is disappointing. And I mean, there's a larger analogy for life in there somewhere, I'm sure. The bit at the end, we all think we're heading towards this thing. We're trying to get something better in our lives, or bigger in our lives, or more, you know, we've got this target. And actually the bit on the way, and this sounds like some sort of trite philosophy now, but it's true. The bit at the end when it all wraps up together is a bit disappointing. If you're made to wait, that's the most enjoyable moment.
Isn't there some sort of phrase, some sort of line about life is the bits that happen whilst you're waiting for it to happen? Something like that, you know?
Yeah.
There's definitely a sense that I think the greatest pleasure can often be taken with the least amount of anticipation.
Yes, good. Love that. All right, Danny. Look, so we are in lockdown now. Loads of stuff being bought. I mean, an insane amount of things. Just to name a few, we've got some heavy-duty, thick, strong, professional bamboo plant support. So you're out in the garden. Miracle-Gro as well. Learn to Read with Reading Eggs box set. So we're doing homeschooling as well.
Yeah.
It's
I'm using the bamboo as a threat, actually. If my son didn't read properly, I would threaten him with the bamboo. Yeah, at that point. Yeah, sharpened.
Very good. Very nice. I'm assuming that was a joke. Fingers crossed it was. And what else have we got here? Look, classic. I mean, how many of these got sold during lockdown? Finesse Professional hairdressing scissors. Those were bought as well. We have got Gorilla Gaffer and Builder's Tape.
Yeah, because you actually have to get the person to sit still whilst cutting their hair, so it's important.
All right, okay, so listen, let's bang on through. All right, Danny, let's leave the lockdown behind, thankfully, and bash on through to present day. Okay, we're going to come crashing through to present day as we get towards the end of this episode of My Mate Bought a Toaster. A Quiet Place, a masterpiece of suspense and terror. A Quiet Place, isn't it?
Yeah, totally. I mean, I was actually having a chat recently with the guy who produced it, so that's why I watched it beforehand. But nice. Absolutely. And I really enjoy watching horror films, and it's something I don't get a chance to do very much because my wife is the most scaredy cat person I know in the whole history of the world. And she has never listened to an episode of my podcast.
No,
and
she hasn't listened to any of it.
Drag her. No, I dragged her screaming to 222, and she did actually enjoy 222. She didn't find it too scary. But,
yeah.
But if you want a quick story just to kind of give you an index of just how scaredy cat she is. Yes. So I was in my shed, which is where I record everything and do my writing, and I bought some new blinds, and I pulled the blinds down, and so you couldn't see I was in the shed. You couldn't see the light. And so she couldn't find me in the house. She could see I wasn't in the shed. So she then became convinced that I had been murdered in the garden. And she did what any sensible person should do.
Yeah.
And she locked the back door to the house to protect herself and the kids. And that was that. And she called me, and she called me up to check, you know, if I was alive or not.
Yeah.
And the phone's ringing, and I go, hello. And she's, oh, you're alive. You're, oh, God, you're alive. I was like, yeah, of course I'm alive. I'm in the shed. And she was convinced I'd been murdered in the garden. And I said, well, like, you know, thanks for coming and checking then, you know, coming and seeing, you know, if my corpse. And she was like, you know, don't be silly. That's what happens. You know, you go and check in the horror film. That's when you yourself get killed. You know, so she was very sensible. But yes, yeah, so, I mean, anyway, I don't get to watch horror films much. And the only time I ever get to watch anything is maybe like I've got this thing now. Actually, I bought myself a running machine that I've got in the office,
oh, yeah.
And the only time I seem to be able to watch like what I want to watch now is on this running machine. I put an iPad in front of the running machine. And I sort of run along and watch kind of my gory, horrific, terrifying horror movies I'm not allowed to watch anywhere else.
Yes, and they're quite comforting as well, because when it gets really scary and you need to run away, you can just crank the speed up a bit and, you know, totally. Feel like you're sprinting to safety. Well, we are sprinting towards the end of this episode of My Mate Bought a Toaster, Danny. Listen, it's been so lovely to catch up with you, and thank you for letting me rampage through your Amazon purchase history. Congratulations on everything. What's going on with Uncanny, please? This is now me just talking as a fan, not an interviewer. When are there more?
We will be back. We'll do more. So the next thing I think we're going to do is another case like Battersea Poltergeist, where we will tell one story across 8 episodes through drama and documentary. Mm-hmm. And then there'll be more Uncanny. I mean, the beautiful thing is there's so many people sending me in these incredible stories, and, you know, just I'm so excited to tell them that they're, you know, they read like real life Stephen King novels. I'm always struck by the eloquence of the people telling them. They're so articulate. And I think recently I think I cracked the reason for that. I think the reason is the level of fear. I think if you've experienced that degree of fear, it makes you eloquent, because the only way you can convey the fear you felt is by explaining it well, you know, like, and any ghost story is about the need for the storyteller to instill the fear they felt in other people. Yes. I think so. You know, I think people remember this so, so clearly, and it could be like 30, 40 years ago, and they will never forget. They remember every single detail.
Danny, thank you so much for joining me on My Mate Bought a Toaster, and huge thanks to that little old lady just behind you on the Zoom call. She's been there the whole time. Dan, thank you so much. That was amazing.
Thank you, Tom. That was a pleasure.
Thank you.
That was a pleasure. In fact, funny, you know, Jason Manford, I went out for a coffee with him the other day, and he told me this story about how he'd been in a theatre. I can't remember which theatre it was now, in some West End theatre, talking to his kid on Zoom like this. And the kid said, "Who's that man in the background?"
Fuck, theatres are fucking spooky. Theatres are fucking spooky.
Jason goes, but and Jason looks around and goes, "There's someone there." And the kid describes the man. And I think he describes a soldier. And then subsequently they found out that somebody had died there, somebody dressed as a soldier. And like,
what?
Properly eerie, properly unsettling story. Yeah. If you ever see him, ask him to tell you the story about that.
Oh my God. It's my mate bought a toaster. Oh, it's my mate bought a toaster. Yeah. It's my mate bought a toaster. Toaster for my love, thank God, toaster. I absolutely love that bit at the end. By the way, here's a spooky story about Jason Manford, who has also been on My Mate Bought a Toaster. If you've not listened to that episode, listen back just for the bit where he fries cat shit. I thought that was a delightful moment at the end. Danny Robbins just dropping casually a wonderful spooky story. Thank you for listening. How good was that? Isn't Danny brilliant? And it goes without saying, if you haven't listened to Uncanny, his podcast, or the Battersea Poltergeist, then I really, really recommend it. They're just brilliant, brilliant listens. That's the end of My Mate Bought a Toaster for another week. Last episode of the series next week. We've got the wonderful Angela Barnes coming on the show. Really excited to welcome her on to My Mate Bought a Toaster. And then there's going to be a couple of best ofs, which is exciting. And then we'll have a break. And then maybe we'll do another series. Maybe we will. We'll definitely will. So that's the plan. All right, team. All the best. Patreon.com/toasterpod.